Good afternoon, everybody. This is Reva Winkler at National Quality Forum. Here with me is Suzanne Terbouge and Jean Cunningham from the project team. Thank you all for joining us for this conference call of work group number 3. We did work group number 2 earlier today, so it's a busy day. But we've had great and productive work group calls by the first 2 work groups, and I expect this one to be equally so. So just to let you know what our plan for the day is, 4 of you have reviewed all of the measures and submitted ratings and provided sort of a preliminary sense of how you're thinking the measures meet the criteria. That was sent to you earlier this morning, and we're going to use that as sort of a starting place for our discussion. What we're looking to do today is find out the issues or concerns about these measures, if there are any questions or clarifications needed, or any responses from the developers that will kind of clear up anything or respond to anything prior to the in-person meeting, so that we're pretty much got the issues on the table and everybody knows what the discussion points are as we go into the meeting. So today what we're going to do is talk about 6 measures. The main materials for the call are the measure submission forms. However you want to access them is up to you, whether you're printed them out and looking at them, whether you're looking at it on your own computer, or we do have them displayed on the webinar, but you don't have as much control over what's viewed that way. So whatever works for you is fine. In terms of the initial submissions, we did get some preliminary reviews from 4 of you, and I would ask for the folks who have yet to review the measures, if you're able to complete those in the next couple of days, that would be very helpful so that we can give a full accounting when the steering committee meets. So just to start us off, I'd like the work group members to briefly introduce themselves as we'll go through the list. Scott, can you just introduce yourself and say a couple words?
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Scott Burns. I'm Senior Vice President of Chapter Programs at the March of Dimes National Office. I'm a pediatrician and pediatric emergency physician by training, and I'm clinical professor of pediatrics at Brown University.
Super. Thanks so much. Elizabeth Dry? Liz?
Hi, this is Elizabeth Dry. I am at Yale School of Medicine. It's the Center for Outcomes Research and Evaluation, and I'm a pediatrician by training, but I've been spending most of the last 5 years developing quality measures, specifically outcomes measures, focused on hospital quality. And although we've moved many of our measures to the NHF process, this is my first time being on a committee reviewing measures. So I'm really excited to participate, both because of pediatrics, and I really appreciate all the work that NHF has done reviewing our measures and wanted to contribute as well.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Rebecca?
Hi everyone, I'm Rebecca G. I'm an obstetrician gynecologist by training. I work for both Louisiana State University and the Schools of Public Health and Medicine, as well as directing a birth outcomes initiative for the state of Louisiana with the goals of decreasing prematurity, infant mortality, and poor maternal outcomes. I've spent a great part of the last year looking at quality metrics for our own reporting and report card and benchmarking, and I'm delighted to join the group.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. Did Craig Gilliam join us? We're missing a person. Okay. Terry?
You're next. I'm Terry Keene. I work with Intermountain Healthcare. I'm the operations director for their women and newborn programs, and I also work as a consultant with the State Department of Health moving towards looking at reporting our information specifically on our preterm births.
Okay. Thanks very much. Dr. Proffitt?
Hi, I'm Jochen Proffitt. I'm a neonatologist and a health services researcher at Baylor College of Medicine. I have an NIH grant on developing composite indicators of quality for neonatal intensive care, and I've been involved in quality measurement and development and public reporting and patient incentives, I guess, for the last 6 or 7 years. I've had the opportunity to be on a previous steering committee, I think about 3 or 4 years ago. So I'm very happy to be back and excited to participate again.
Great. Thanks, everybody. Just to let you know, we do have several other steering committee members who are listening in to your conversation, and we do have representatives from the major developers joining us to respond to any questions or concerns of each of the measures. So first question I'd just like to ask everybody is, everybody's got the measure submission materials correct, and are you having any particular issues accessing them on SharePoint? Okay, good. That was initially an issue, but it seems to have been resolved, so that's good to know. Okay, with that, I think we'll be able to move into the discussions of the individual measures. So the first measure that is up is measure 475. This is hepatitis C vaccine coverage among all live-born infants prior to hospital or birthing facility discharge. This is brought to us from the CDC. And this measure is for maintenance review. It was endorsed in NQF's previous perinatal project in 2008. And Terry, I think, is this your measure?
Yes, it is.
Great. So I think what I'd like to do is go through each of the main criteria and look at the preliminary evaluations and then have you sort of start the discussion around any issues the committee feels needs to be brought up around. Let's start with the importance criteria.
So as we look at the importance criteria and separate them, I'm the only one that thought it was moderate. Everyone else felt it was low.
Really?
So I don't, no, it was interesting. Again, there's only four of us that have given input on this. So the ones that are on that did not give input, it'd be interesting to hear their thoughts.
Yeah, I'm looking at the importance criteria, and under the 1A impact, I've got two mediums and two highs. Under the gap, which is 1B, I've got three highs and one medium. So I guess I want to be sure we're all on the same page.
And maybe I'm looking at the wrong, maybe it's sorted wrong.
Maybe we can just, I don't know, can someone just recap the measure briefly while before we,
Okay.
Because I'm still just pulling them up. I'm sorry, again.
Not a problem.
And I'm pulling my notes and I just think, yeah.
Yeah, and you can sort the list of measures to just look at 475 on the Excel spreadsheet.
That's why I sorted by 479. Give me a minute here.
Not a problem. Just to talk about, this measure is the percent of live newborns that receive hepatitis B vaccination before discharge at each single hospital or birthing center during a given time period, typically 1 year. Okay.
All right. I'm sorry. I sorted by the wrong one, so you'll just have to give me a minute here.
Not a problem.
If you want to lead it while I am.
Well, in this case, while Terry's pulling hers up, the importance criteria to recall is the first one is impact. The second 1B is the gap or opportunity. In other words, do we have data presented that demonstrates that there's still opportunity for improvement? And then the third is the evidence. And since this is a process measure, we are looking at the body of evidence to support providing hepatitis B vaccine for newborns, and specifically how strong that evidence is in regarding the quantity, quality, and consistency of that evidence. In general, this was rated moderate to high on most of these categories by the four people who've already given their preliminary review. So, Terry, are you?
You know, I must have saved it. I had four other things going in. Can you just resend it? I don't know what I did. I'm sorry.
Okay. Let's see if we can do that. It may take a second.
Yeah, I apologize. Can we start with one other one and then go back?
Yeah, okay. We can do that. Just to kind of give Terry a chance to reorganize herself, let's move to measure 479, then, which is the birth dose of hepatitis B vaccine and Hep B immune globulin for newborns for Hep B surface antigen positive mothers. This is brought to us from the California Department of Health. Again, this was a measure that was endorsed in our previous go-around with perinatal measures. And I believe, let's see, who's
it's
up?
It's me, Rebecca. So let me just, hey, everybody, let's just talk briefly through it. So this is a California Department of Public Health measure. Rather than the last measure that focuses on hepatitis B broadly, this measure focuses on mothers that are actually infected with Hep B surface antigen, serological evidence of hepatitis infection, and their newborns receiving the vaccine. And so I was thinking I could go through just a little bit about the measure, the evidence behind it, and then just sort of briefly through the categories. Many of you mark this as low or intermediate, medium importance, which I would agree with. Let me just say why. So the numerator is the number of infants born to Hep B surface antigen positive mothers who received a birth dose of a Hep B vaccine and Hep B immunoglobulin upon delivery. You need both the vaccine and immunoglobulin to have maximum effectiveness. Then the denominator is the number of infants born to mothers who tested positive. Exclusions are stillbirths, miscarriages, obviously, because they would not be eligible. This measure is collected from electronic clinical data. It's not, there may be chart abstraction, certainly from laboratory data if that was not available. So it's not a, certainly birth records. You're looking at clinical data, predominantly electronic records. So what's the problem? Well, prior to the development of the Hep B vaccine in the 1980s, there's research out of London and other places looking at how many infants are actually infected. Well, if you have a mother and you have, particularly in Asian populations with the Hep B E antigen, transmission can be as high as 90%. Depending on other types of hepatitis B, you can have 7% transmission. So depending on your population, transmission can be high, although not the case in every population. And certainly since the development of the vaccine, the problem has been ameliorated greatly. So the goal of this is to reduce the transmission of hepatitis B when possible to these mothers. One of the questions I had about this measure was, it specifies that it be given within 12 hours of delivery. There's evidence that there's effectiveness up to 24 hours after delivery, although the sooner the better. One of the things I'm wondering that I wasn't clear to me was how are we defining or measuring when it was given? How do we know it was within 12 hours? So that's one thing I would ask the measure developer. So I'm not sure how we're defining through a data perspective the timeliness or the time that the vaccine was given. Where would we find that? So that was one question. Looking at high impact, 1A, I would say low impact just because even though it's a priority, even giving immunoglobulin and vaccine, there still would be a small chance that the infant would get hepatitis B. Even in California, they're still, when they looked at their data, for a year, there were 2,000 infants born in 2009, and almost all of them, 97%, 0.1%, received the first dose, although they don't give you of Hep B and the immunoglobulin. So this is a very high percentage, and it's still, as I said, not 100% of these infants will get chronic hepatitis B and have sequelae later in life. There's what seems to me be also a measurement difficulty, given that this comes, from medication records and electronic data records. For some facilities, may or may not be easily this measure may or may not be easily gotten to. So looking at high impact, I voted low, and the group generally lived in the low to medium category just because this is not a common problem, and given that the vast majority of infants are already getting this, the number of cases, and I did not do the math, would be very small. Opportunity for improvement, again, low, given that more than 95% of infants are already getting the vaccine. Evidence, you know, there's very good evidence for vaccines. We can't argue with that. ACIP recommends it. We know that it works. It's an important health outcome to avoid hepatitis B, certainly. Maybe I'll leave, then we can go through the rest of these boxes. But I would maybe stop there and then let the group comment at this point on what I've said.
Yeah, this is Jochen Profit. I think I had exactly the same thoughts as you did regarding, you know, regarding this measure. I mean, this is a very worthwhile, you know, undertaking with regard to the, you know, the importance of the, you know, providing the vaccine to the to these infants and the immunoglobulin. But it seems like the problem is largely fixed, and it didn't seem necessarily that the burden to the hospitals of reporting this would really be in any relation to the additional benefit that we could accrue from this. So I felt like there's maybe more important measures that also then would allow you to truly measure differences between hospitals with regard to quality of care. The numbers, 3% within California, is so small that I would feel like it'd be almost like rather a random event in any given hospital for it not to occur. And so public, I don't know how meaningful a public reporting would be on this measure.
Right. Comments from anybody else? Scott, you and Elizabeth also weighed in on this one.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all pretty much been said. I'm not going to be redundant here, but I did notice the 97% number, and perhaps the writer of this measure can talk about any other national data that might be available. You know, I'm just looking across my comments here. I did struggle a little bit with this measure and also the other measure around hepatitis B in terms of whether it really met an outcome measure sort of criteria, but ultimately you're really trying to prevent, you know, the Hep B infection. And let's see, what else did I have here? I just had a question about what about parents, what about those who refused the vaccine, how are they accounted for? And, you know, my main issue was really around what was just discussed in terms of, from a public health, from a measurement standpoint, it's already 97% in California. What's the real evidence that this would be helpful as a national measure?
And just to add, the developers agree that some of this may need to be extracted from paper charts. And so given the burden of reporting, it's not like a measure, other measures where it's right from vital records or something where it's easily extracted. When folks have to go into paper charts, you're really using a lot of will for improvement up. And so, you know, I think I feel and agree with the other two comments that it doesn't seem that the opportunity for improvement warrants necessarily the burden of reporting.
Okay.
This is Terry. I feel the same way. Also looking at the cost per data element, that there are other measures that we could get more benefit for the community as a whole with the cost per data element.
Hi, it's Elizabeth. Also agreeing with the general conclusion that there's already high performance and it's a relatively small target population. And I also wasn't clear how the eligible infants would be identified vis-a-vis their documentation of their mother's status. So I just didn't know where that came, you know, because it can always come off a infant's newborn record. I don't know. I think in a lot of places probably you'd have to look in the mother's chart, and if you're chart abstracting, that's a lot of work. So I also just thought maybe the staff and NQF could comment a little bit more. This is a narrowly focused measure among the measures that we're looking at today. And, you know, there may be certain hospitals or certain environments or certain cities where this would be an important measure versus nationally. And so I think we're talking about whether it meets the importance criteria, and that's the fundamental criteria it has to meet, right, to move forward onto the rest of to continue to be considered. So how do you think about measures that are, you know, I don't see that it's needed necessarily in any particular regions or states or areas, but if it were, you know, how do you think about a measure that is really focused on a potentially a small population that's up for re-endorsement that really doesn't, at this point, nationally seem to be important?
And this is Rebecca. Let me just comment quickly that I think there's a reason why this comes out of California. I mean, Hep B, E transmission is very high. It's highest among Asian populations, California having one of the highest Asian populations in the country. So I'm not saying it's not valuable for California, but that's the other question I'd ask is similar to the last question, is when we take something that may be regionally valid, but say it's of national validity. You know, in California, just calculating, there would be 24 infants that, and of those, not all of them would have long-term disability in an entire state in a year. I would think that it would be much lower in other states per population. So any historical information about, you know, when you have a measure that's specific to a certain area, how we think about that?
Yeah. This is Reva. Not really. I think the questions you raise are particularly appropriate, and I think when it comes to usefulness, that's sort of what you're addressing in some of the usability criteria, as well as I think the other big one you landed on was really the opportunity for improvement. Also, impact. Now, this is one where perhaps you're really also talking about impact with the small population at risk, particularly when it's regionally based. You had a couple other questions about the measure, which even though the importance criteria is a threshold criteria, we want to be sure that any other questions about the measure are addressed in case the steering committee doesn't the entire steering committee doesn't totally agree with the work group. So I guess I'd like to hear from the measure developer if they have any response to any of the comments, but realize that there were other questions embedded in some of the specifications about the documentation for the timing of administration, how do you determine the maternal status from the neonatal chart, and what about parent refusals? So do we have somebody from the measure developer with us?
Hi, my name is Chrissy, and I am from, I wasn't the original developer, and but I'm from the offices of the developer, and the form was submitted by California DPH. Catherine submitted the form. Unfortunately, she couldn't have been on this call with us, and she is probably actually the best person to address these questions, but I will try my best. As far as the timing questions, from what I know, Catherine told me that the measure is getting the vaccine and the HVIG within 12 hours of birth, because these are the ACIP recommendations. Actually, what is reported from California DPH to the CDC is actually whether or not the infant has received it within 24 hours. So I don't believe that there is a specific timestamp on it for us to know whether or not it was within 12 hours. The other question in terms of regionally, yes, so regionally California would have a high number of Asian population, but there are also other states in the U.S. where I think that this would be equally valid, where there are high Asian populations. We have a lot on the East Coast, in New York and Maryland. I believe Virginia is pretty high up there. In Texas, there's also a large Asian population. So while, you know, historically there is the larger Asian population here in California, we do believe that it's equally important in the rest of the country. Can you remind me what the other questions?
The other questions were about parent refusals and getting the information on maternal status from the newborn chart.
So for parent refusal, I believe that it was just counted as not receiving the HBIG. Is that the question? Does that answer the question? And then for the maternal status should be listed in the newborn chart. When they went and took the when they went and reviewed the maternal infant delivery charts, I believe that the maternal the status of the mother was already listed on the infant charts, but I actually am not sure on that one.
May I interject for a minute? This is Tanya Walker from CDC. It actually is a recommendation as part of the Peri-Hep B program. They're supposed to have a copy of the hepatitis B surface antigen test result in both the mother and the infant chart, so it's a requirement.
And this is Rebecca. One of the things I'd like to know, if you don't mind taking back potentially for the broader discussion, is why was 12 hours chosen for this measure when the 24-hour has been reported? And what was it? I would like to know the thinking on that.
Maybe Tanya can help me with this, but the 12 hours is the ACIP recommendation. So that's the way that the measure was developed.
Yes, the ACIP recommendation is 12 hours specifically for these infants because they are born to hepatitis B surface antigen positive women. And we actually I'm in charge of managing a side project in which the five sites, which represent about 28% of the births to hepatitis B surface antigen positive women, have to provide that information to me just to see if it is occurring when it's supposed to occur.
And how do you?
I myself have been trying to work to get that change. I think that if we're saying that they should receive the shot within 12 hours, then we should be asking that you all report it that way.
Right. And the other question I had was on how are you measuring timeliness of the vaccine being given? I don't know where in a chart. I mean, you'd have to paper abstract that, I would assume, to know exactly what hour it was given, or is there another way?
Are you saying this is for reporting purposes, how we know when the immunization is given?
So your metric is based on timeliness of the vaccine.
Right.
I'm wondering how are you measuring that? Because usually in an electronic record you may not, you know, you'd have to go back to when the birth was, when the vaccine was given. How is that easily available, or what is happening?
With the electronic records, that's actually much more easily available than before with the paper records. I mean, you can still go back even with paper records and, you know, do a chart review and get that information pretty easily. That's very clearly documented. But with the electronic records nowadays, it's, you know, it's, I bet they could even pull the data from the back end, but it's very easy to pull. If you were to do any chart review or abstraction of data, you can find that.
Thank you, ladies.
Okay. So those are some questions, I think, that speak to the specifications and any issues around scientific acceptability. Were there any particular questions around the usability criteria or the feasibility criteria? I think we did address some of the feasibility issues. I just want to point out that the importance criteria actually is a threshold criteria. If it does not pass the majority of the steering committee agree that it's important, then we'll stop right there. So it will be important that when we're presenting and discussing it, that we lay out the criteria in order. And just as a preview, what we'll do is ask you to present, you know, kind of a concise summary of the issues around the importance criteria, entertain whatever discussion the rest of the committee wants to have, and then we'll ask the committee to vote as a group on the importance criteria. If it passes, then we'll move on to scientific acceptability, usability, and feasibility, but if it doesn't pass, we'll stop right there.
And I'd like to just echo what Chrissy was saying about the kind of importance and applicability to the entire U.S. I mean, our particular focus happens to be on Asian Americans because we're the Asian Liver Center, and there's a large Asian population in California. I mean, Asians in general constitute about 4% of the U.S. population, and with 10% being chronically infected, that's a not insignificant amount of the population. But in addition to that, the actual recommendations for screening and those coming from high-risk populations actually include Eastern Europe, much of South America, and Africa as well. So, you know, when we wrote the, I don't know the measure how it stands today, but I mean, you have a lot of kind of Eastern European populations all along the East Coast, in a lot of refugee populations among Asians that are kind of scattered in the South and the Midwest. And those populations have higher than a 10% chronicity rate.
Right.
So I don't want to just say that it's only applicable to the U.S. because there are actually quite a few kind of foreign children, foreign-born, whose parents are from an equally high endemicity.
Yeah. Reva?
Yeah.
Reva? This is Scott. I know we have to move on, but I think that, what really was an issue in this section, at least from my perspective, was the lack of the other data outside of California. So I think that's a key point here in terms of meeting that threshold, in terms of what's the magnitude of this issue outside of California, since they're already at a 97% compliance in California. And what was written in the proposal in the measure didn't really reflect that. I think that at least is an important point for me.
Okay.
And to add to what Scott just said, the other point was there was no note of how many infants have actually been affected and infected with Hep B, and I think that would have been also helped the argument.
Okay.
Chrissy? To broaden it even more, this is Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, so we're going to talk about a measure that looks at Hep B vaccination for all infants, and it affects a much broader population, but it affects this population as well, and just from my reading of the Welsh type measure, I'm not an expert on this at all, you know, it is getting a Hep B vaccine, even if you don't get immunoglobulin, is an important benefit to babies of Hep B surface antigen positive mothers. And so I'm just wondering, should we be thinking about the value of this measure as a marginal value on top of the other measure?
Yeah.
In the sense that, if we're making sure everybody gets a Hep B vaccine at birth, what's the added value of this? That would be one way to think about whether its value in national public reporting or even in more regional.
So I certainly don't want to, I think the bigger measure certainly is getting the vaccine to every newborn. That certainly has much greater impact. I can say that, though, the addition of the HBIG for children born to mothers with hepatitis B confers about an additional 25% protection.
And who is talking? Sorry, I'm wondering if in the early part of these discussions we can still identify ourselves.
This is Stephanie Chow. Okay. I joined the discussion late, so I apologize if I'm duplicating what's already been said.
So even if you think, even if it's that 25% incremental benefit, if it's over a very small population and there's a high burden to collecting the data because it's a chart abstracted measure, potentially involving more than the infant's chart, but maybe not, that's how I would think about it. After you measure and report on the immunization, what are you conferring in terms of health benefits by measuring and reporting on this across all these hospitals?
This is Reva. Just to respond to Scott's question, this is exactly the kind of thing we're going to ask the steering committee to think about. One of the sort of basic approaches is to look at each measure individually to see if there are any, major sort of structural or fatal flaws to the actual measure. But then once we've done that, to step back and look at the group of measures to see how they work together. And you're asking the right questions about things like additional value of, a group of measures on a similar topic. Do we need all of them? Do they all add value? So the questions you're asking are appropriate and should be factored into your evaluation of ultimate recommendation measure.
Yeah, what I can say is that these measures really are complementary to each other. I think that's a large part why the ACIP and the CDC kind of advocate these recommendations apart from the measure, but these recommendations hand in hand. We don't really advocate them separately. And I think that if you are going to be doing the chart abstraction for the other measure, this one is not much more difficult to abstract. I think we can give you population-based data for other states to show that this hepatitis B chronic infection is an issue in other areas as well as California. The California Health Department helped us grab this data. I'm not sure that we, in the period of time that we have left, can get the equivalent data from the other states right now.
And do we have data on number of affected infants?
I think the CDC does, but we have to go back and look that up. Part of it is, you know, there is a problem in that you only know that the infants are infected if you go back and test the infants, and compliance is actually not great. So, you know, we know the overall infection rates of infants if they're not infected, if they're not immunized, which is, you know, 90% of those who come into contact will develop chronic infection. But the problem is that we don't, in our country, we have such poor follow-up with these infants oftentimes that you don't know if they end up developing it without the infection because those mothers are not, you know, kind of included in the system. So the data is,
and
incomplete.
That gets at one of my other follow-up questions. I don't know how much more time we want to spend on this measure, but that's what I was looking at the data. It's really the problem with this issue is more the follow-up and the lack of getting the full vaccine dose, the lack of follow-up on testing the babies to see if they're positive. I wonder if our focus ought not be on that issue rather than an issue where over 97% of infants already are getting the appropriate treatment. I mean, why don't we focus where there's the major problem?
Well, so it's, I mean, they do go hand in hand, right? So part of the issue is that without measures that kind of support the importance of immunization, the follow-up is really non-existent. So we need measures and data to demonstrate the importance of immunizing in time, giving to HBing in time. And this data has been around for a while, and a lot of it comes from Asia. And once that these are quality measures, then you can hold the hospitals accountable. And this has been an issue that we've been dealing with for a long, long time, which is that, you know, it's the hospitals have to follow up, the health departments have to follow up, and without kind of these quality measures, then money gets spent elsewhere. So it's kind of like a catch-22 in a way.
Can you give us, I mean, I'd be curious what the SCHIP measures are and, you know, I think it seems to me more of a pediatric rather than a hospital issue, but I would like to see if there are other measures out there that look at the follow-up and measuring success in a number of vaccines. I'd love to see that too, if we could have that presented.
You mean in terms of other vaccines?
No, Hep B. What happens in terms of, are there any metrics that look at children receiving full dosage and then follow-up testing of infants? And I don't know what's appropriate, 6 months or 1 year, or what's appropriate timing, but, you know, looking at appropriate timing of retesting as well as full vaccine administration.
Okay, this is Reva. I'll be happy to take a look through our inventory for any of our child measures. This is something that Susanna, Jean, and I do also. For any measures in terms of the later, more outcome of the disease kind of measure. But I think we need to move on to just go back and discuss measure 475, which is, Terry, are you with us?
I am with you.
Great. So this is the hepatitis B vaccination administration to all newborns prior to discharge. So why don't you go ahead and kind of take us through the criteria.
So do you just want me to do the test? Go on to the so the brief description again is the percentage of all live newborn infants that receive vaccination during a given time period, the 1 year. The numerator is the number of live infants getting the vaccine, and the denominator is the number of the live newborns born at the birthing facilities. The exclusions, again, are based on ICD-10s, which are very difficult at this time to get. It's a measure. It's an improvement process. And as we look at this, do you want me just to go through what, since we're running short on time, just what we all said? Because we're all pretty consistent here.
Yeah, let's hit the high points of what we all said. Right.
Okay. So as we're looking at the impact, we were all moderate to high on that. And if it met the importance, we all felt yes. Again, the scientific measures, we all felt yes.
With
the usability, we've got one low, two moderates, and a high. So as we look at this, it's the feasibility, three moderates and a low, and then as far as met criteria, evenly split with two yeses and two noes.
Great. Okay, so it looks like everybody's pretty consistent in terms of the importance criteria and the solidness on the evidence and opportunity for improvement. Again, very similar, everybody had a rated the scientific acceptability. I think you're raising the point about the exclusions being in ICD-10 can be noted. But I guess where it starts to really diverge is under usability. And Joachim, you rated it low. You want to comment on why?
I'm trying to find right now what I thought about. Sorry, not to have all of these on the top of my head. These ratings, but I guess the usefulness of public reporting on, and this was whether or not a baby receives hepatitis B during the birth hospitalization. I think there was an issue with the, didn't the measure developer even say that there's an issue with the parental refusal? So I didn't think parental refusal was probably a problem in the case of a hepatitis B positive mother, because I'd feel like it's probably a rare event that they would refuse their child to be vaccinated. But I think it's a really, it's quite a common, it's actually quite a common event of parents refusing hepatitis B for regular newborns. And then I think there was a mentioned, I can't quite find exactly where it was, but there's a mention somewhere in the description that stated that really parental refusal was very difficult to actually ascertain. And because of that, I felt like it might be quite difficult to look at this measure with regard to public reporting if there were systematic differences with regard to populations and how they, and how frequently they might refuse this vaccination. So I think that's mostly where I was concerned about this measure.
Yeah, this is Scott. You know, just to add on to that, because I have had some questions here, really around what appeared to be, as written in this measure, the varied capacity for hospitals to provide this data. And to actually report on this measure. So I was really questioning the challenges to implementation in terms of actually getting valid data in order to track this. That, so I just wanted to add on to what Dr. Kopich just said there.
Yeah. Can the folks from CDC tell us what the current state of the use of this measure is and whether it's publicly reported anywhere that you know of?
The measure itself is not used per se because it is a new measure, but every year the states have to provide information on birth dose within 3 days, which essentially is birth dose information based on hospital discharge because, of course, the average hospital stay ranges from 1.9 to 2.9 depending on complications of the women, and it ranges around 60%. But even though the recommendation, ACIP recommendation, is that all infants are vaccinated with their first dose prior to discharge. Did that answer your question? If not, then...
Well, I guess, so that... Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry, this is Elizabeth.
Yeah.
I guess I wasn't sure also what stat, like there's testing going on in, with the measure, even around the issue we were just discussing. I'm looking at 2B5.1. Meaningful differences in performance, and 2B31, which is analysis of exclusions. I'm on, it's probably the easier to say, I'm on page 14 of the measure, but form. But if I wasn't sure what the status of reading this of the testing around, you know, parental refusal and documentation of that and ease of that and what the intent was even. Is it under specified measure without that exclusion?
Well, it was suggested when the measure was time-limited endorsed. We didn't have a feasibility study at the time when Dr. Wong submitted it. She was the developer. She's not with us. She's with WHO now. But when you got, well, when we got the time-limited endorsement, it was suggested that the feasibility study include taking the parental refusals out of the denominator so that it wouldn't count against the hospitals. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, so it sounds like there was a little bit of an effort to look at that
Right.
Or there was an interview, and I wasn't sure exactly. Did you just ask hospitals whether they could do it?
I think the hospitals were asked to try to do it and report it on, and in that way report it on whether they could by whether they were able to find the information or not. So.
But there were problems with that, right? This is Jochen Profit again. I think.
Say 38% of hospitals query were able to make the adjustment for vaccine people.
Yeah. So I think that's my primary. I think actually, like, if I'm looking through this again, I think I rated 3B low. That's probably not. I would probably revise that higher, like reading through this again, because I think for quality improvement it's quite useful. But I think as long as the as we at least have a good measure of how much of a difference it would this parental refusal makes across hospitals. If it doesn't, I mean, it's possible. This kind of appears like a big problem to us, but it actually isn't.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, I think it'd be fine to just go ahead with the measure. But I feel like I would need some more data on how much the parental refusal actually influences performance ratings.
Okay.
And another thing that I think would be helpful would be to know the status of other immunization measures that are NTEP approved that are process measures like this, you know, is this even addressed? I mean, it could differ by immunization. Some are refused more than others, but it would help me to sort of benchmark it against where other measures of this sort are. Point.
Okay. Yeah, this is Reva. That's something I can certainly provide to you, I think, offline, because I think we don't want to spend the time on that now, because it
absolutely
is a giant issue. It absolutely is a giant issue on how do you capture and report patients who got vaccinated, patients who refused vaccination, and then patients who have contraindications, all of which add, you know, contribute to the overall outcome of the measure. But I can send that to you offline if you'd like. Terry, are there any other issues? I think you all have talked about the scientific acceptability, your concerns about how refusals are handled, the capacity for data collection, and then the feasibility, which a lot of those were feasibility issues.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions or additional information the group would need to kind of clarify some of these things? Anything we can ask CDC to provide for us before the meeting that may help the evaluation of this measure?
For me, another thing that would help, again, just thinking about the value of this hospital-based measure, would be to know what the ultimate Hep B series compliance strength is for newborns. Not, you know, this is did you get it in the hospital versus did you, I don't know what the percent are that get it.
The compliance rate for the birth dose or the entire series?
Well, this is the birth dose, right? But I think even for just for the first dose, right, if you looked in and out of hospitals, do we have a number for that?
In and out of hospitals, no, we don't. We only ask for the information by day three, which is generally, you know, by discharge.
CDC doesn't have a number for immunization rates or, you know, the number of infants or the proportion of infants that get that first dose.
I think I might find the information, but I know that for a fact that the only information we report out in the or ask in the National Immunization Survey is by day three. And I know that that's around,
okay.
That's between 60 to 65. But in terms of who completes the, who gets that that first dose overall at any time, at any point, I might be able to get that information. Oh, I know I can get the information to you. I just got to find it. I can't give it to you right now.
Okay.
So.
But we'll be happy to follow up, and if you send that to us, we'll share it with the committee.
Okay.
Okay?
Thanks.
This is Jochen again. I think if I maybe hear that comment correctly, one of the things that I've been wondering about the hepatitis measures is we've been giving hepatitis now for how long to newborns? Maybe about like 10 years or 8 or 9 years, something about that, like that. And with the general, you know, increase in hepatitis immunizations within the population, I kind of wonder, you know, whether the actual hepatitis cases over time will really drop off in newborns and whether, you know, you could always measure whether the process is being done in the hospital, but the value of that measurement is likely to decline over time because of the success of vaccine programs. So I guess, you know, maybe this is where we felt like we were with the other measure, that, you know, maybe at some point, you know, the actual value just of the actual measurement declines. Not that the process itself is important.
Anything else from anybody on the hepatitis measures before we move on?
I guess on the, this is Stephanie Chow from the Asian Liver Center. Just to address that last question that was raised, is the concern that there's no more need for this measure, or that there's not enough data on the effect? I'm just unclear for that about what that question was asking.
No, mine was less of a question than a comment. So, you know, I would just think that over time, hepatitis rates in newborns will decline based on an increased hepatitis immunization rate within the population.
I think that is somewhat true, but I think in the last year or two, the recent data that came out showing acute infections in children really declined dramatically with the implementation of the birth dose of hepatitis B. So, and
right,
with the continued immunization, continued immigration of just, you know, hundreds of thousands of immigrants from high-risk countries, I wouldn't say that we've quite reached the point where this is a, you know, obsolete measure.
All right.
Okay,
so let's move on. The next measure is measure 478. This is nosocomial bloodstream infections in neonates. This comes from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, ARC. It's the percentage of high-risk newborn discharges with an ICD-9 diagnosis code of bloodstream infection. This is an outcome measure. This measure was endorsed during the previous perinatal project. And this one, Craig Gilliam was the lead discussant. Did Craig join us? Okay. So we're going to have to kind of limp along without Craig. Four of you I'm sorry? Hello? Okay. So on the preliminary ratings from all of you, everybody rated it as having high impact. There were three highs and one medium on opportunity for improvement. This is a health outcome, so the evidence rating isn't the same as for process measures, but it's felt that there is evidence that there are actions and ways of reducing nosocomial bloodstream infection. And all of the four of you said that the measure would pass the importance criteria. Were there any particular issues about this measure you wanted to bring up? Or does that pretty much summarize it?
That summarizes it for me.
Okay.
Yeah, good job.
Okay. All right. So under scientific acceptability, again, I think we have a mixture of medium and high for reliability and validity. This is a measure from ARC. It's based on administrative data. Just one other thing I wanted to see. The level of analysis is at the level of the hospital facility. So I would guess that some of you have had experience with this measure, or your hospital has been measured by this measure, perhaps?
Yes.
Okay. Carrie, was that you who said yes? About it? Any comments on your experience with this measure?
It is very hard to look at some of the elements if you don't have an electronic medical record, which is one of the concerns. Pulling out some of that, I'm sorry, someone just came in my office, of course. But looking at this, it is a little bit hard when you're looking at some of the finer elements, but again, is a definite need for reporting. We're working on reporting in our state for the newborn. So I just feel like it is a good measure. And as hold on just a minute. Let me just switch on mute, and then I'll get back with you.
Okay. So
This is Rebecca. I would agree with the other reviewers, and I also think the focus on the highest risk infants is appropriate, you know, those less than 1,500 grams, premature or, you know, significant adverse events.
Okay.
So I like this measure. I think it's meaningful for improvement. Some folks are starting to focus just on central line. That's not an aspect of this measure, but I certainly don't argue with the relevance of it.
Okay. We're going to talk a little bit later once we get through all these measures about other related measures, and so hold that thought on a CLABSI measure. We'll get there.
Yeah, Reba, I'm glad, this is Scott. I'm glad we're going to get there because I just feel like the greatest challenge is going to be doing exactly that because some of these measures are just so close
exactly.
that will be probably the most robust discussion for us to have about these four measures from my perspective.
Okay, and so I'd like to be able to just kind of go through each as an individual, which is the first step, and be sure there aren't any serious issues or fatal flaws, if you will, on any of them. So in terms of the usability and feasibility, pretty much there was a mixture of high to moderate for the ratings for both of those criteria from the four preliminary reviews, and that everybody felt the measure was suitable for, that it meets the criteria. So does anybody else have any comments on this one?
I did have a couple of questions that I just wasn't sure about, but they're, I mean, I think that's maybe what Scott gets into. Like, to some degree, some of the detail of these measures become really complicated. And I got to say, just from reading them, I wasn't 100% sure about what would happen. But if the measure developers are there, I'd have a couple of questions. So for this measure, I was wondering, like, what if the patient dies? Does that make a difference? I think it doesn't, but you know, as long as infection is in the diagnosis code, I think it's included. But does that, you know, so if a hospital has a very high mortality rate, they put themselves at a lower risk for infections, right? Because
that's right.
So is there any?
It increases their denominator.
Right. So if you spend more days in the hospital, if you have a higher survival rate, then there's more days that the patient is at risk for an infection. So you know, I guess I'm not saying like anybody will have a perfect answer for this, but this is something that is being investigated at least in these measures. And another question was about transfer. What if patients are transferred back to other institutions? It's the same kind of question. It's like if a unit transfers a lot of patients out early, then they're going to, you know, they might have a lower infection rate because a patient is at risk for lesser time.
Also, the death and transfer are both in the denominator, and I don't know if the denominator adequately addresses them, but they're addressed, and I don't know, you know, certainly.
Is that transfer in or transfer out?
Transferred from another health facility.
Right. So I think that's from transfer out, right? Transfer in, right? So if the patient was outborn, does that mean outborn? I think that means outborn, usually.
I think it means they've come in from another facility.
Right. But I guess what I was thinking is, like, you know, some hospitals will essentially keep babies until they're close to going home. And other hospitals will send a lot of them out to you know, some of their satellite facilities. So if you send out a lot of babies, maybe still while they're having IV nutrition, et cetera, then you know, you put you can lower your infection rate by having these patients be at risk for a short amount of time while they're in your hospital. I mean, those are real details. I'm not sure it's worthwhile getting into, but I thought I should raise them at least for the developers to kind of say they're thinking about these or trying to address these.
Right. Is anybody from ARC on the line?
Well, before, can I say something to Elizabeth? Because I would just, before we get ARC to address that, I would agree with all those things that somebody who develops outcomes measures, and we are always thinking about issues like, you know, how we try to use a standard follow-up period, so the length of stay, as you're describing, wouldn't affect the outcome rate. But here, clearly, if hospitals who keep their babies longer are going to be at risk of having a higher risk-adjusted infection rate. my impression when I looked at this measure, and I think this is the one that the Joint Commission is working to align, right?
Yeah.
This is the claims-based one, and the JC has a chart abstracted one. I'm really impressed with the amount of, like, careful consideration of each of these issues, but some of the design features, if somebody thinks that outcomes measures and the NQF guidance on outcomes measures are a little bit, I mean, I would like to understand them better, too, which is why I wanted to squeeze my question in before our talk. For example, you know, some of the relevant outcomes that you would care about that are sequelae of infection, like death, define the denominator, and I think that's kind of unusual. That's another, you know, you have to think about whether that can introduce some bias into the measure, and there are other issues like that. But I feel like the measures have been worked on really intensely by people who are the users of them as well as the developers, and I think it's really worth understanding them better if we can and spending some time on those details, because certainly for these measures, we all agree on the importance criteria, but the details are going to define whether they're a really scientifically sound measure or not, and that's another important criteria.
And this is Rebecca, just quickly. I would love to know what percentage of infants are transferred and what is the scope of that issue? I'm sure it depends on your level of NICU. But just in thinking, those are really important points, and I'd just like to, I don't know if we have data on that.
Right. Do we have anybody from work with
us? The variation on the transfer rates and the variation on the length of stay across hospitals that would be measured, that would, both those things would be informative.
Okay. Is anybody from ARC on the line with us?
Yeah, hi. It's John Bott with ARC. So what that last question maybe we can look into before the November 29th meeting is the person inquiring about the percent of infants transferred out to another facility?
Yeah, what is the percentage of infants who are transferred during a NICU, you know, an infant goes to a NICU, what percentage of those infants are transferred at some point during their NICU experience?
Transferred from the NICU experience to another hospital.
Exactly.
Okay. I'm not sure. We'll see if we can look into that before the meeting. So there was a question about in-hospital deaths. So in the denominator statement, so these are, you know, folks at higher risk of the infection. So the third denominator criteria is birth weight greater than 1,500 grams and potential for some conditions to be met, and one of those is in-hospital death. That's the only case where, in that case, somebody meets the denominator. The way I read the specs is, for the first two denominator cases, birth weight 500 to 1,499 grams, that the person could die or live and be in the denominator. Gestational age between 24 and 30 weeks, the person could live or die and be in the denominator. But if the baby's at over 1,500 grams, one of these two conditions under that have to be met to make the denominator. And there's another question about transfers out. They're in the denominator unless the length of stay was less than 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the questions I wrote down that I believe somebody asked.
Yes. Well, yeah, thank you for that. I guess the question is essentially about sort of potential biases that arise with transfer, and can we, are we able to, to at least sort of account for them or figure out what the magnitude of that bias might be.
A covariate is transfer in, so obviously we saw saw that was substantially related to the outcome of interest. So we have one case in the covariates of what we call modified DRGs, where if the person died or was transferred to another acute care facility, that's also a covariate. So it's taken into account in the risk adjustment. So that's trying to be responsive to at least some of your questions. So
yeah.
So a couple of those examples, those situations are accounted for in the risk adjustment.
Okay.
And this is another thing that would be helpful to know, if you do know, you may not have the data, but administratively, in administrative data, it's not hard to find. If you could just describe the variation in length of stay of the infants in the cohort, because if you have, you know, hospitals that have, they just by policy have a different, so sort of they observe the infants, so less chance there is for them to develop an infection. And some of that's going to be transfers, but some of it may also just be, you know, differences in home support and exactly when they send him infants home, et cetera.
And
okay,
this is
so
a,
the, oh, go ahead.
It's Rebecca, just to get to follow up on that question as well, has this measure or other infection measures been stratified by level of NICU? Because I would think that would account for some. Certainly if you're a higher level NICU, you're more likely to have higher risk infants for longer periods of time. Has that been looked at?
Well, there's what we call canned stratifiers and the ARC quality indicators. I'm almost positive that's not one of the canned stratifiers, but there's, you know, always the potential for the user of the software to stratify the data in ways that they're able to, that your one data set allows them to. So if I haven't seen that information, but if somebody has that granularity in their data, they could stratify that way through the ARC software. But I can ask if we have that, but I haven't seen it. And also I made a note of the variation in length of stay and denominator events. So I'll see if we can gather both of these few things before the meeting.
So for this measure as well as for the Joint Commission measure, could you explain a little bit to us, and I'm sorry I don't know this maybe as well as my other colleagues, like how those ICD-9 codes are gathered? Are all of them gathered from a chart review, or this is all from what people submit as claims, or is it, like sometimes health plans will only have, like they'll only record like the first two or three ICD-9 codes, and or they'll extract them all, but they'll only look at like the first two or three. So would you have like a long list of diagnoses, whatever is being recorded on an individual patient, or, you know, are only the first couple kind of extracted? How does it sort of practically work?
Well, for the ARC quality indicator, I'll let the Joint Commission talk about their version of the measure, which I'm not as sure of. It was Dr. Patrick Romano who worked the most closely with the Joint Commission in the harmonization of the measure. So there'll be a much richer conversation of this on the 29th of November when Patrick will be there in person. So with the ARC-QI software, it's approximately 30 diagnosis codes and roughly 30 procedure codes are accepted into the ARC-QI software for processing to compute this measure.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other questions around this particular measure, 478? This is the measure from ARC you've been just talking with John about before, because the next measure is essentially the same measure, but it's specified by the Joint Commission for a different form of data collection. So does anybody want to have anything further they want to talk about 478 before we move on to 1731 and talk about the specifics of the Joint Commission version of the measure? Okay, then let's do that, and let's go to 731. Scott, I think this is your measure, and we have Ann and Celeste from the Joint Commission on the line. So, go ahead, Scott.
No, go ahead, Mia. What were you going to say?
I just wanted to mention the measure that we just talked about, 478, was originally endorsed during the prior perinatal project, and the Joint Commission had selected five of the measures from that project to put into their new maternal child health measure set. And this measure
is submitted using the data collection system that the Joint Commission uses for all of their measures, which is different than the data collection that ARC uses, and so therefore we have a second measure. But my understanding is there's been a tremendous effort on both of their parts to keep the measures as harmonized as the data allows. So with that, I'll let you take it, Scott.
Well, I think we're finished with this measure. No, just kidding. I just want to first start out by saying that I thought this was very, very well written. This measure titled Healthcare-Associated Bloodstream Infections in Newborns, as you noted, submitted by the Joint Commission. The measure assesses the number of septicemias and bacteremias in high-risk newborns. And you'll note that the numerator and denominator is pretty much exactly the same as the last measure. Is that correct? Did I read that correctly, Reva?
I believe so. We'll have the Lesson Company verify it.
Yeah, I think there was one typo, perhaps, under denominator statement. It says, or birth weight equal to 1,500 grams. I think it's greater than or equal to, 1,500 grams.
Yeah.
It is noted on page 16 that this is adapted for measure 478, and Reva answered one of my questions, which was what actually prompted this being adapted from 478. So why don't we just go to those who reported here on the spreadsheet, and I think we've all ranked in terms of importance either high or moderate, and importance all yes. So I don't see any comments except for me. What did I say here? Consistency results across study section blank. Oh, yeah, that section was left blank, but there was plenty of information in other sections to help me answer this. So I just put a little note in there about that. Any questions about importance or other comments from those who have reported in here or those who've read it and haven't been able to respond to the survey? All right. The next section, we all... it looks like, in terms of acceptability of measure properties, reliability and validity, looks like we're pretty much in the moderate range. Elizabeth, you might want to make a comment as well. I think we did both note, I think, if I remember correctly, the note in the measure right up that further reliability studies would be done late in 2011. Not quite sure exactly how that impacts whether this gets endorsed or not, but I'd like to hear more about that. From the Joint Commission. And then I was curious that some of the measure exclusions were not derived directly from the evidence. So I think there was a mention in there about CMS, and just curious about on that comment in there. Anything else on this section, on Section 2, from anybody?
So one of the things, this is Rebecca, I wondered was why 120 days? Where was the thinking for length of stay? More curiosity in terms of, was there a data point inflection there?
Did you want to have the developers respond to those questions about the scientific acceptability right now?
I think that would be helpful for the group, don't you?
Yeah. Celeste,
sure.
Can you?
Sure, Reva. Hi, this is Celeste, Joint Commission. The reason for the exclusion for those patients that are there greater than 120 days has to do with how we've aligned all of our measures with CMS. Basically, it has to do with billing cycles, being billed on a quarterly basis, and sometimes measure specifications change from quarter to quarter. We did do an analysis of that exclusion, and it does appear that we, about 3.64% of the time, we do have some patients that stay longer than 120 days. So it's only been applied because we do it consistently with all of our core measures. That would have been the rationale.
Sounds reasonable. Thank you.
And Celeste, maybe you can answer the question about the reliability studies that were coming, or maybe they're already here, and then the measure exclusions that were not derived directly from the evidence.
Okay. It's timely you're asking about reliability because I'm in the throes of that right now. I'm leaving to do another visit tomorrow, so we'll have completed 5 visits as of tomorrow, and we won't have our entire 12 visits completed until the end of January. So the reliability visit you saw was some inter-rater reliability from some hospitals that were currently using the measures, but we will have an update on that. And actually, I can tell you, for the most part, we're matching pretty closely when we do these site visits. Now, you had questions about exclusions that were not from the evidence.
I was curious about that comment that was made in there.
I'm trying to find it here. I know that my sheet looks different than your sheet.
You know what? It's a relatively long document.
Isn't it?
So I can't do a word search, but there was a note in there about some exclusions that were not derived directly from the evidence, and I was just curious about that. But.
Well, the 120 days would have been one.
Okay.
The length of stay of less than 2 days would have been the other. The enrolled in clinical trials would have been the other. And the clinical trial, once again, that would be another thing that is common to all of our core measures. And when we ran the analysis on that, it came out that it was 0.02% that patients were enrolled in clinical trials. So that was an extremely low amount. And that was analyzing 356,671 cases.
Yeah, that's right. It's page 19. That's exact. Those were the three that were listed.
Right, right. So,
yeah.
And it's kind of just how we do the measures here. And I think the thought process was if they're there less than 2 days, they're probably getting transferred to another facility because they're really sick, or they're a very healthy baby and they've gone home.
Got it. Riva, how are we doing?
I think you're doing fine. I guess one other question I would ask both John and Celeste is, given you guys have worked hard on harmonization, could you outline how these measures are different after your harmonization work?
Do you want me to go first, Riva?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, this is Celeste, Joint Commission. There are some differences. One thing that we do allow for with our measures is that we do allow for the hospital to actually view birth weights, because not all birth weights are captured with ICD-9 codes. They actually stop at once you reach 2,500 grams unless there's a problem with the baby. So we do allow for them to interface into their systems to pull out actual birth weights. That would be one thing that's different. And because we are actually allowing for birth weights, we don't use gestational age as another criteria for bringing them into the denominator. We try to be very straightforward. They're either 500 to 1499 grams, or they're greater than 1500 grams with at least one of the following. They would have had to experience death, mechanical ventilation, major surgery, or have been transferred in within 2 days of birth. So we kind of made it a little more clear-cut with our denominator.
Before you go on, you clearly, you know this measure so well, you're going too quickly for me.
I'm sorry.
I thought that measure 478 did that as well. I'm trying to look at that. What, because they do it by birth weight, no?
They do it by birth weight, but they don't allow birth weight. They allow ICD-9 codes, which may not always be present on the medical record if this baby's a healthy weight. They won't be coding for a birth weight if they're a healthy weight. Let's say they're 3,500 grams. There is no ICD-9 code for a healthy 3,500-gram baby.
Yeah, but they're capturing those who are above 1,500 grams who have the same, I think, the same three inclusion criteria that you have, right?
There's actually four when they're 1,500 grams, and yes, it's the exact same. We harmonized in that respect.
Okay, in terms of death, in the operating or procedure ventilation. Okay, got it.
Yes, they're exactly the same.
But
we actually worked further to harmonize all of our code tables as well. We realized that there were some codes that should be removed, some that should be added to actually a lot of the tables. So we worked through each one of the tables and did a side-by-side comparison.
This is
Rebecca. I think one of the things that's nice about this measure is you don't get gestational age where, you know, date problems with dating criteria, documentation of dating, et cetera. You're not, you're just concerned about birth weight. So I think I don't think that any other measure uses only weight. Is that correct?
We'll have to look at them and see. It's usually a combination of the two.
Small for gestational age may be a significant predictor of infection now. So I guess you could say it's a benefit and maybe an advantage and a disadvantage at the same time, right?
This is Terry. I feel the same way, not having the ability to look at both the weight and the gestational age.
Okay.
Have you run any correlation analysis between the Joint Commission measure and the ARC measure? Like, I just wonder how they're so similar, like that. So I find myself, I actually didn't submit this measure because I felt like, okay, I feel like I would have to say the exact same thing as for the ARC measure, and it eluded me a little bit to tease out the exact differences between these measures. So, and I guess one of my concerns would be that the steering committee would agree to, give the stamp of approval for all measures that are all related to the same kind of greater constructs, and then make hospitals do work on four or five different measures that all kind of, measure really a very similar thing, which I think is the whole point of the harmonization work that you've been doing. So I guess I just wonder, like, how closely are these hospitals correlated when you compare them between your measures, and is it worthwhile having two measures?
I think Reva, you were trying to get us to that, right?
Well, I think the question that he asked was one I was actually going to pose. Is there any, or do you plan on doing any comparison between the two to really understand how well they compare? I mean, on paper with the specifications, they seem as closely aligned as you can get, but how do they behave given the different data systems? I think that's a question that would be sort of generally useful going forward. My guess is you don't have that data, but it would be great if somehow you could capture that sometime. Any thoughts like that, Don or Celeste?
I don't know if we've done that analysis. Like I say, Patrick worked really closely with Celeste on this, but so maybe Celeste right. knows if we've produced that during the work, but Celeste?
I'm not aware that anything was run in that respect. We do have what our rates have been, where we've been using it nationally, and I guess the only thing I can say is that this is one of five measures in a set of measures that when a hospital selects our perinatal care set, it's one of the five that they would select. So they are reported as a set.
Right.
So this is Scott. If I'm hearing you correctly then, and basically, the Joint Commission adapted Measure 478 so that its members who report their data through your system can report it, who choose the five or, the perinatal care core measure set. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, that's correct. We've specified it like all of our other core measures.
So then I guess the question for the steering committee will be, from a harmonization standpoint, and endorsements, it's really the same measure, but it's actually, and I know you did a lot of work to put this together, I can tell them based on the write-up, but it's really meant to, I'm trying to figure out the reason for potentially endorsing this as another measure as opposed to the mechanism through which Joint Commission folks who report on the measures are able to report on this.
Yeah.
Measure. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Scott, this is becoming a huge issue, as you've rightly pointed out, and Joachim has pointed out, that many measures on the same topic makes it very difficult for the world out there. And so one of the next steps that we're going to be discussing on the agenda on the 30th is this issue of related and competing measures. And we actually have, NQF has some guidance around it. When we look at measures for these two, they're essentially the same measure. Is it acceptable to have two? What might be the reasons for it being acceptable for having two? Or, and that's a real discussion point for the steering committee going forward. And I think, as someone mentioned, this, we've got a whole series of them that are very similar. And we're going to have to apply it and look at some side-by-sides and really tackle what is truly a thorny issue. And so, but our first step is really to look at the measures individually and find out, be sure we understand everything about them as individuals, because if we find the measure as a fatal flaw for some other reason, then it's off the table and we don't have to think about, the comparison part. So that's really what we're trying to do today. And so I just alert you that our next step and some of the materials for the in-person meeting
will be additional information on that guidance for looking at these very similar measures. And also I'm going to pull in another measure that I think it was Scott mentioned earlier on CLABSI that was dealt with in another project, so that we can really start looking at the pros and cons of these very similar measures. And asking that the question you're asking is, what's the value of having all of them? What are the differences? You know, at the end of the day, do we need all of them, or do they all provide value? And so we'll do that as a next step. But indeed, it is probably one of the most difficult issues the steering committee will have to grapple with going forward. But we will do it because it's so very important.
Well, that's really helpful. And this is Scott. I appreciate that. So maybe to help things go, keep rolling here, it's 4:30 Eastern time. In terms of the usability and feasibility, the three who reported here did have a range in terms of usability, and Elizabeth may want to comment on here. And then feasibility was moderate or high, and we all said yes in terms of suitability. So, Reba, I'll turn it back to you for any other thoughts or comments we need to address for this measure.
Okay.
Well, this is Elizabeth. I will squeak in a comment, I guess. First of all, I think that was you, Reba, saying that you're going to have a side-by-side on these measures, which would be fantastic. So we'll eagerly look forward to reviewing that along with the guidance about how to balance them. And I think I heard someone say that this measure, I just want to clarify this before we go further, which is this measure, the Joint Commission is thinking about allowing this measure to be used in, I mean, the 478 measure, the claims-based measure to be used in lieu of this measure. Was that true or no? That's what I thought I heard them. I mean, anyway, we don't have to get into it today. We can take it up later. But the two big issues for me were, one was already raised, which is, you know, what is the correlation and if you're using these so, you know, carefully aligned measures to assess hospitals, are you seeing a correlation in the performance and the reported rates in the end? Because that's, if you're saying they're the same measure, you'd really want to know that they were assessing hospitals primarily. But more important, I'm just looking at page 20 of the application. It's concerned, and I'm really sensitive to raising this because I develop outcomes measures, and a common critique of our measures is that they don't show enough variation. Well, the concern about this measure is just that the range of the outcome rate, the risk-adjusted outcome rate, it doesn't say that, but that's what I think they're presenting on 2B5.3 on page 20. There is a range from 0 to 1.64% in the 90th percentile, but none of the differences were statistically significant. And I don't think that's a killer, but the variation is what it is. I'm not somebody who would say, well, that, you know, they don't show enough variation. What the measure should be showing is a measurable variation. But that's just something to think about when we think about the usability of the measure. Is it able, given the sample size we have and the event rate, and the variation that's within the hospital versus just between patients, are we able to really show that statistically there are differences? And so it's great. This is a really complete application, and it's just something that the committee could think about. I don't know. ARC didn't seem to have similar, the ARC measure didn't have similar data. It showed the raw rates, but not the risk-adjusted rates. I'm just citing the point. I think I've confused people, but basically the bottom line is that the results do not show any statistically any differences from the target range for the 79 facilities.
All right. So you think the usefulness criteria is your concern? Is everybody?
Well, I mean, there are ways to address this, you know, that are independent of the measures that are. There's ways to work around it, for example, combine 2 years of data. Basically, you need to get more sample size, right, usually, to have statistical significance on a low event rate like this. But I think it's an issue to think about. If you're going to report and none of the results are statistically significant, you know, how we have to think about how useful the measure is.
Correct. I think that's a very good point.
And I think we should have the similar data available for ARC. I think they probably have that, but I didn't see it in the application.
Okay. See if we can pull out something to do some comparisons. Okay, we have two measures left in the last half hour. And this is measures 303 and 304. And they both come from Vermont Oxford Network. And 303 is late sepsis or meningitis in neonates, risk adjusted. And 304 is late sepsis or meningitis and very low birth weight neonates, risk adjusted. And I just want to ask the developers the question, is 304 a subset of 303?
Yes.
Okay. So essentially, they're both the same measure. It's just one is applied to a narrower weight range, birth weight
That's
range.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a narrower population. That's correct.
Okay. So given that, perhaps we can be efficient in discussing the two measures together.
Sure.
And Joachim, that's yours, I believe.
Yes. So I guess I'll just start with the number 303. So essentially, 303 or 304 includes only babies less than 1,500 grams, and there's some gestational age criteria 2, and 303 is a measure that includes also larger babies. Is that fair?
That's
I think
correct.
That's fair to say. And so this is a measure that is already being collected by, I guess, over 900 NICUs worldwide that are part of the Vermont network, Vermont Oxford network. And the numerator, infants either need to have essentially a positive blood or a CSF culture obtained after day 3 of life, so it's sort of the classical nosocomial infection criterion, or the other criterion is to have a Coag-negative staph plus certain other criteria that would suggest that this baby is being treated with the intent of treating an infection, so treatment for 5 or more days, or generalized signs of infection. And then in the denominator, essentially, all eligible infants after there are 3 days or older.
After day 3, actually.
After day 3.
Yeah.
Where day 1 is the date of birth, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so I'm just going to take a look here at the ratings with regard to the importance ratings. Most of the ratings were within the high and moderate range, except for Scott, who had insufficient rating on criterion 1C. Scott, would you like to comment on that one?
Yeah, I just would have liked to have seen more there. I mean, I know that the studies are out there, but I just felt like, you know, I think the answer in that section was numerous, and I just felt like that there could have been more written in there. Although it did still meet the ultimate threshold to move on from here. That's why I coded it as insufficient.
Okay. Does anybody else have any concerns regarding the importance criterion? If not, then I'm going to move forward to scientific acceptability, which again really was rated mostly in the moderate to high range, except for Elizabeth, who had some concerns regarding the scientific accuracy. Elizabeth, would you like to comment on your concerns? This was 2C. Is Elizabeth? Hello?
Yeah. Elizabeth.
Sorry, I was on mute.
Okay.
When I looked at Elizabeth, sorry. I just felt like the denominator, and maybe I didn't understand it correctly, was really complicated, and there was a lot of data abstraction. There's experience with the measure, so it was more of my just finding concern reading the specifications, wanting to understand better how accurately this information can be abstracted and whether there's, you know, mechanisms in the these are pulled out of a registry, correct?
That's correct.
And reported for participants in the registry. So I just didn't know what the quality of that data is. basically, and how well it's reported and whether there's any validation of it or, you know, sampling of sites. There's a lot of uncertainty to me about what's going into the measure calculation and its quality. That was the main.
So I think one key point about that is that our manual does give specific definitions of the items, but we do have extensive business rules that look to see, are the measures consistent with other information we have about the baby. So, for example, if the baby's not in the hospital after day three, then they're excluded from the denominator, and we have rules that make sure that that occurs. So, there is an issue with any measure, of course, with data quality. That is something we're very concerned with. We have an extensive finalization process each year, for example, that we go through to make sure that all the data are collected and that there are no errors in the data, again, with these business rules that we have implemented. So you're right to question that, and I think that from our standpoint, at Vermont Oxford, we try to make the definitions operationalized to the point where they're reasonably easy to understand, and then we verify the data through these business rules and so on. So I think we're doing the best we can with that. That's all I can say.
Yeah, I mean it's always hard, and it's great that you're using registry data, but I mean if this is somebody reviewing it, it's hard to know any of that.
This is Rebecca. One of the things I wondered was how important is the type of bacteria? And I'm sure you've looked at that, but we'd love to know more about it, particularly how important is coag-negative staph? Did you look at this measure excluding coag-negative staph cases? What proportion of cases could be attributable to that? How much, there's some debate within the field about how meaningful, and that's why I think you have these exceptions or additional criteria with it. How important is that as a contributor to actual morbidity? So just would love to hear more about that, the thinking behind the bacteria.
So in 2010, for example, which is the last year that we have finalized the data for at this point, for the population that includes very low birth weight and larger babies, we had about 116,000 babies in the denominator. And the nosocomial bacterial infection rate was around 3%, a little over 3%. And we do look at coagulase negative staph separately from the late bacterial pathogen. It was about 2%, 1.6% in fact, for coagulase negative staph, and 2.1% for late bacterial. Now, for the very low birth weight population, which is this is more important measure in that population for sure, we had about almost 53,000 babies in that category in 2010, and the nosocomial bacterial infection rate was around 15%. So, and that breaks out to about 8.3% for coagulase negative staph and 9.1% for late bacterial pathogen.
Thank you.
Can I just pick up on that for a minute? This is Scott. I realize that very low birth weight infants are higher risk of infection, and that's perhaps why you said it's more important. But I would think the aggregate measure is perhaps more important because it would give you, even though the percent might be lower ultimately, given the denominator is larger with some lower risk babies, wouldn't that be more reflective of how you're doing, a better reflection of how you're doing in your NICU overall? I mean, you know, Vaughn has been doing this for years, so I'm just curious on your answer to that.
No, I think that's true, that if you're interested in looking at your NICU as a whole, that for sure, including those bigger babies is important. And in fact, I mean, we do stratify, for example, along with doing risk adjustment, we stratify by birth weight category and gestation. And so, you can look at the bigger babies separately if you choose to do that. I chose the wrong word. All I was trying to say is that it is much more prevalent in the smaller babies.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Arthur, this is Elizabeth again. Are the data submitted from NICUs and the broader pediatric population of hospital across hospitals or just NICUs?
Well, for the smaller babies, it includes any baby that's between 401 and 1500 grams at birth or between 22 and 29 weeks gestation. For the bigger babies, we only include infants who are admitted to the NICU or who die within 28 days of life in the reporting hospital. Did I answer your question? I may not have.
So if you're in a regular newborn nursery and you are you considered in the measure or if they report on you or not? For the bigger babies?
For a bigger baby, you have to have been admitted to a NICU or have died in the hospital within 28 days. So it's based on NICU admission or death.
Okay. So really not really covering the non-NICU population.
I did have a question about that. I think that's criterion 3 in the numerator details. So in a lot of tertiary coronary care centers, there's a cardiac ICU, and it seems like a lot of babies might fit and be cared for in a cardiac ICU, but that would not routinely really be submitted to Vermont Oxford unless that unit was somehow part of Vermont Oxford too, right?
Well, that's the point. The way we define eligibility for the larger babies is that they have to have been admitted to a NICU, which we define as a location in your hospital that provides intermittent mandatory ventilation.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure if that would always apply to a cardiac care unit.
Mm. Yeah, I guess that's just probably very specific to individual hospitals. So, we would have many babies in our ICU, cardiac ICU, that would be ventilated.
And I don't know if it also just, it's challenging with registries, the set of routine data collection that varies across the hospital. So I'm just wondering if generally you're just getting data on NICU babies because that's where they're set up to.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Yeah. I had one question about the statistical analysis with regard to the shrinkage, and that's probably true for many of the hospitals with the other risk adjustment measures too. So we've toyed with shrinkage on some of the models that we have run, and sometimes what happens with the hospitals that have small ends, they might be in the middle of the pack even if they have zero infections. And I guess I just, so this is one of the concerns I personally have for the public reporting, because a hospital could, unless the data is presented well, you could have, done everything right and not have an infection, but be listed essentially as sort of a mediocre provider.
Well, it's true. I mean, if you're a small hospital, what the shrinkage does is it controls for noise, if you will, so that if you have few babies, then we don't want to send a signal that you're doing better or worse than expected, unless there's good evidence. For example, I was looking at another measure, not this particular one, recently, and there was one hospital that had 32 babies that there was a signal for the entire year. In fact, the measure was mortality, and this particular hospital did worse than expected. So, I mean, certainly is possible. They had quite a high mortality rate, but. But what we don't want to do is just routinely signal that you're doing better or worse if you're a small hospital without good reason for doing so. So that's the whole idea, is you basically are shrinking the value of the observed minus expected statistic or the standardized ratio statistic toward the mean value based on size.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's a... I think in the documentation we provided, we gave some information about an empirical Bayesian method that we use for shrinkage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see. Does anybody have any other concerns about the scientific aspect of this measure?
I would just add again, this is Elizabeth having, you know, worked a lot with similar models and outcomes measures. In the end, I mean, kind of stating the obvious, it's frustrating as it is when you have very few observations. You can't really draw any real conclusions with outcomes measures, and so there's strategies, you know, you can try to accumulate more observations by going over more years of data, and
right.
And that we're just a little bit stuck and have to keep going anyway because we want to measure outcomes, but it's hard to do with very small hospitals.
Yeah. Okay. Then with regard to usability, with regard to public reporting, I guess we have measures going from low to high. I'm not sure if we've already talked about that right now, or if somebody wants to maybe Elizabeth, you said low, and Scott, you said high. Maybe if you...
I had a caveat on mine there, just in terms of the usability, and maybe I'm looking to see what Elizabeth... Yeah, I think Elizabeth had the same comment.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the usability for VON members.
Right, that's correct.
Yeah, that's what I was commenting on. So.
Mm-hmm.
And no public reporting unless the hospital chooses to do that. And then I think you had a comment on that as well.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then feasibility, of course, is kind of has similar comments, I would think. Elizabeth, again, you had a couple of lows.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's very hard. I don't know what proportion of hospitals are participating in the registry at this point.
Yeah.
And what proportion of, let's just narrow it to NICU, you know, just babies admitted to NICUs. I don't know if it's big or small, but it is a big investment, and it's a measure that you really have to have the infrastructure to set up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a little more concerned about the broader measure, as I think other people have expressed, because... Again, if you're not sure which populations of babies you're capturing versus not capturing the measure, I'm just more concerned about implementing the measures similarly across hospitals.
It would be kind of interesting to figure out the correlation between the VON measure and the ARC and the Joint Commission measures to me, because so the ARC measures are all based on claims data and the Joint Commission as well, if I understand that correctly. And VON measures are based on essentially chart review, either electronic or paper-based chart review. So there's, you know, there may be a trade-off in doing chart review. Maybe you might get higher quality data with all the data checks, but you also may have more burden of collection.
This is Reva. Just to say, the Joint Commission's data collection is also. They use their vendors who use data collection tools, which are frequently chart-based, whether electronic or paper.
Okay.
So, Celeste, if you're still on the line, did I get that right? She may not be. But that's the typical Joint Commission. They use vendors to do the data collection for any of the measures in all of the different topic areas.
Okay.
So, I think...
Yeah, I think for the last question that Elizabeth had, I think there's about maybe 1,900 NICUs or so in the country, or about 2,000 NICUs in the country, as far as I know. And then I'm not quite sure how many NICUs are part of Vermont Oxford within. Maybe our contact from VON has that number. How many U.S. NICUs are part of the VON?
One second, let me see if I can find that number.
Well, while he's looking that up, I can tell you that there are around 800 level 3 NICUs, which would be taking care of those very low birth weight babies.
Mm-hmm.
So. It says 293 hospitals on page 3.
Okay.
And I know we have 17 facilities in Louisiana that report to VON, and we're doing a statewide quality improvement effort around this data. And we have not heard a lot of complaints from facilities about
the Vaughn metrics. It's fairly well tolerated. People have bought into Vaughn, and you know, our groups have been much more early adopters of using these NICU measures than they have on the maternity side. So I didn't have any concerns in the regard of usability, just because my docs love to complain when I go talk about quality improvement, and they haven't complained about Vaughn.
Just as we're getting to the last minutes, I just wanted to ask if there was anything about the second measure, 304, which is just limited to the very low birth weight babies. Was there anything in addition to it? And I guess sort of a question for everybody is, why not just stratify measure 303 by birth weight? Is there a need for a second measure?
Well, we do actually stratify by birth weight, but when we do the risk adjustment, it's a different population. So,
okay.
You know, to report the measure for someone who's reporting all their babies is a different model.
Got
it. And if I might just say, we have 654 U.S. hospitals that participate in Vaughn.
So
654. Yeah, and that's pretty high. I had one last comment on the measure, which is the risk assessment includes race and, you know, and NCAP guidelines, and my own view is that you shouldn't be risk adjusting a race because we'll adjust away differences in quality that we actually want to eliminate in a measure like this. So that's the concern is if you have, for example, worse outcomes for blacks, the expected on these measures for black patients will be higher. Hospitals, you know, are sort of held to a different standard when you incorporate race in the risk adjustment. So that's, I'm not happy with that about this particular measure, and I think it merits discussion at some point, if not now, then in the steering committee.
It's an interesting point, and I'm sure we could spend quite a while talking about that one. But, I mean, I guess there has been quite a bit of discussion here about improving our models, and we have looked at that in particular, and we don't find that race makes much difference, in fact, as far as predicting infection. We have not changed our models, but it is something that we're considering, you know, for the future.
This is Reva, just to mention that in general, if you look at NQF's evaluation criteria around risk models and disparities, we generally encourage and support not including disparities type population variates in covariates in risk models, such as race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, and all that. NQF is in the middle of doing some further work on measurement of disparities, and those kind of recommendations are due out fairly soon, and so it's an ongoing conversation, but it is an important one to begin addressing things in the same way.
Thank you.
Okay. We're right at our last minutes, and we don't want to keep anybody over. As I mentioned, this concern about the fact we've now just looked at four measures all talking about essentially nosocomial or healthcare-acquired infections, whether they are bloodstream or blood plus CSF or any other measure I'm going to show you is just central line associated, they're still very tightly related. So this will be a big issue for this particular set of measures to grapple with. So in the next couple of days, look for further information as we start comparing these. And we're going to want to compare things about, you know, what type of infections are included, what type of babies are included, what time frames are included, what are the definitions of how an infection is determined to be captured in the numerator. So all of these are important issues because even if we have multiple measures, we would certainly want them to be harmonized so that hospitals aren't trying to respond to multiple disparate measures. And that I'm going to encourage you all to keep that concern about the users having to respond to multiple different measures in the forefront of your considerations, because it is certainly a message we hear loud and clear from all sorts of users out there. So,
could you quickly say something about what happens typically when, you know, an NQF measure is approved to do health plans? Then usually go to hospital and say, you know, this is NQF endorsed. Please go ahead and submit this information to us. Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a whole lot of variety of things, but certainly there are lots of potential implementers who look to the NQF list of measures to develop programs, and certainly health plans do it, health systems do it, states do it. For instance, like Medicaid programs might, you know, have a different set compared to other health plans. So we certainly know that there are a wide variety of potential implementers who do it. So it's quite conceivable that a hospital is reporting to the Joint Commission, their state is reporting the ARC measure, which is a common thing. You can go to any number of state websites and look at data on the ARC QI.
Mm-hmm.
That same hospital's reporting to Vermont Oxford. Okay. And then the CLABSI measure, which is, I'll bring in and show you, is from the CDC.
Right.
So, you know, everybody feels a little bombarded, and when they're not aligned and not harmonized, it just can make you crazy.
Yeah.
So we're going to want to keep that in the forefront and really pay some significant attention on asking the question, do we need all of the measures? And for the ones we feel we need, are they harmonized? And wanting to put yourselves in the position of the folks at the in the hospitals who are collecting the data and doing the reporting, which many of you are, you know, how crazy do you want your life to be? So it will be an important conversation that we're going to address on the second day of the meeting. And it's a difficult one. It absolutely is a difficult one, but it's one that's critically important. So we will be doing that. I guess the last thing I'd like to ask all of you is because we're trying to get ready for this meeting, is there any other information, any other questions, anything else you think would benefit you and the rest of the committee about these measures that we can get or provide for you? So that going into the meeting, we have everything we need and the committee can make decisions that they feel comfortable with. Okay. Just certainly if there's something that rises, don't hesitate to get in touch with us. But we didn't want to overwhelm you up front. But we will be providing additional information. We'll alert you. We'll post it to SharePoint on some of these other things that we've talked about, going beyond the initial review, the side-by-sides, the answers to all the questions that the developers that you've asked today. Similar things are happening in the other work groups. So we're trying to pull all that information together. Sometimes the developers are updating their measure submission form, so we'll have a new version of that for you. And we're going to try and keep all of that clear in terms of what the most up-to-date information is as we go forward for the meeting.
And Rita, this is Lisa. I'm hoping that my early ratings and comments are just for our own internal discussion today, because I've learned a lot today, and I don't know how other people feel, but it was a kind of a cursory view of the measure. So I was just wondering what you're intending to do with that, with the SurveyMonkey results.
Right. What we'd like to do is we're going to use that much as we've done here. We're making slides out of it as a starting point for the entire committee to discuss. So if you'd like to make changes to them, you know, that's fine. We can adapt that. But that's how we're going to use them. Okay. Well, if there are no further comments, we're at 5 o'clock Eastern and at the hour for finishing. I want to thank everybody for being on the call. Thank you for giving us your time. To the operator, is there anybody out there in the audience who wants to say anything? What's your name, Rebecca?
And those lines are open if they have
right.
any questions.
Is there anybody out there who wants to comment who's been listening quietly? Okay, that means it doesn't appear to be any public comment.
So my thanks to everybody on the work group. We really appreciate all the time you've put in so far. And I look forward to meeting all of you and seeing all of you when we get together in about 2 weeks.
Terrific.
Thank you,
everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's presentation. We do thank everyone for your participation.